TalkZone presents Money at Work, the weekly show that addresses the issues of the day from a financial perspective. Now, here are your hosts, Steve Memory and Brian Bourdon.
Thank you. Welcome to this afternoon's edition of Money at Work with OB Capital Management. We're coming to you from our office at 109 South Fairfax Street in Old Town Alexandria over TalkZone.com. I'm Brian Bourdon, and as always, I'll be joined shortly by my partner and co-host, Steve Memory. Steve is the Senior Portfolio Manager here at OB Capital. Remind you that OmniVinset Capital Management is a registered investment advisory located in the Commonwealth of Virginia and subject to all the laws, rules, and regulations governing such entities in the Commonwealth. On today's program, we're going to take a look at a number of issues that have profound effect on the market, something we don't normally do because they're largely political in nature. Now, as we all know, investing has pitfalls in it and concerns other than just, you know, interest rate risk and market risk and risk of default. There is also, in some cases, political risk. And that is something that we're going to take a look at today. We're not typically a political program. There are dozens of such programs on the air for you to choose from that will be more than happy to get your emotions all roiled up and get your bile rising and just make you absolutely miserable.
That instead, sounds like fun.
Instead, we're going to look at events in the Ukraine today. That's going to be probably what we'll lead in with, you know, as this first segment goes on. Another hot topic out there right now, especially among those vying to curry favor with you, is something called the income gap that we're also going to take a look at. And then we're also going to examine some of the financial reports and data that are coming out and, you know, kind of take a look at how they affect what's going on. And currently, as we start the program off, we're going to do what we usually do. We're going to take a look at the major indices we follow to give you kind of an update on that, how they're faring today. So we're going to bring in Steve right now. Good afternoon, Steve.
Afternoon, Brian. How are you doing?
Good. Take a run at the indices for us. Now they're usually up when we come on the air. I don't know why that is, but that's always the case. But they have backed off from their highs today. In fact, the NASDAQ is kind of hitting into more seriously negative territory. So why don't you take a run at it for us and let us know what's going on out there.
Well, thanks, Brian. I appreciate that. And yeah, I'm actually looking at some data here that's probably a little back off of maybe a little delayed. If you've got some things, I still have the S&P up about 2.5 points. That's 0.13%. You know, not doing gangbusters here. We started out this morning, opened up close to that 1880 mark. We actually crossed in above that 1880 mark. Oh, probably about the 10 o'clock hour or so before started pulling back. It's just been in the last hour or so, I guess, that we've started to see some significant pullback in the S&P. I don't know, maybe that because they heard that Lily's not going to be on the program with us, and they decided, hey, wait a minute, we can't have a positive market without Lily.
I was going to say, I was going to try to keep that on the DL, but somebody found out.
The Dow Jones, on the other hand, still up. We're at, 16,418, I guess, and change. Again, we may be, a little bit. That's as of the 159, which is the last, data I had right before we came on the air. So we were still, to the positive, somewhat trending down. We hit, 16,450 earlier in the day, or just, right below that. Let's see if I can go ahead and be absolutely accurate. 16,448, I guess, is the highest mark I've seen here so far today. But, you know, hey, it's up from yesterday, significantly better than where we were on Tuesday, and particularly after the sell-off that occurred on Monday. You know, Monday being a bit of a tough day in the marketplace, everybody very concerned about what we had going on with Russia and Crimea and the Ukraine. A lot of uncertainty out there. And it's, you know, whatever your politics are, the one thing that the market doesn't like is uncertainty. And as they say, you can live with just about anything except not knowing. So That's at least a good sign. People have gotten a little bit better grasp of what's going on with Crimea situation, with the the situation with Russia and what's happening out there. We went ahead and had that ultimatum. I think we had that 3 o'clock deadline that Putin was out there. It sounded a little like Obama putting a red line in the sand. But
it all started in November. Russia was pressuring Viktor Yanukovych, who's the Ukrainian president, well, he was at that time, to turn his back on the deal, the trade deal that they had with the EU, and he accepted a $15 billion bailout from Moscow. You know, Moscow, the Ukraine.
That didn't come with any strings, did it?
Oh, I'm sure not. Yeah. Ukraine's been, 60% of the population is Russian national. So Putin's kind of in there under the auspices of, like Catherine the Great when she was pulling this kind of thing. It's like, oh, we've got to protect the ethnic Russians. That's why we're going in there.
Sure.
But there's also that little plum within the Ukraine that's Crimea with Sevastopol, the port there in the Black Sea, which would make a really nice jumping off point, not just for, Putin's yacht and water skiing and all that, but, a nice naval base would be.
The game Risk? Do you remember how that was? Wasn't Sevastopol, wasn't that one of those places where you could go ahead and put, I think I used to put a lot of my plastic armies there.
Well, you're like Vladimir Putin and he probably did the same thing. Only now he's doing it for real. And the big news that we've seen, coming up to, current events is that, first of all, they're ignoring Yanukovych has been ousted. He's out of there. The protests and everything got him on the street because the Ukrainians didn't want him. They want Putin out of there. They don't want to go that direction, at least half of them. And they're not, of course, Putin's not recognizing the new leadership in there. Arseniy Yatsenyuk is in there now, and they're not dealing with him.
I thought you were going to say Arsenio Hall. I thought, man, the guy went from late night to running Ukraine. That's not too bad.
I think it'd be a step up.
Hey, actually, one of the things that they were doing there was a lot of Ukraine wanted to be more European-like, and there was some things that they were, could sign, become a little more European oriented, and I guess they had a inclination to become part of the EU. Russia, on the other hand, wants to kind of develop more of an economic situation to counter the EU. I guess and the first thing that comes to mind would be, what's the letter that follows E? it's a that U.
Yeah.
I guess we probably really shouldn't go down that road. See, you bring up Crimea, and I was not going to get into this, and now I'm in the all right, I won't say the bad pun that everybody hates that I've been walking around with, totaling. All I get are groans, so I'll leave it. Anyway, the point is that, there's a lot of stuff going on, and there were the protests that occurred in Kiev were largely brought about because the president at the time had not followed through on his promise to move closer to Europe. And so we were going ahead and seeing a lot of people. Obama was pointing fingers, saying, hey, you guys got to stop shooting your own people. And, that was, I guess, the original cause for the ultimate ouster of his presidency. Going ahead and I guess he just kind of took off one weekend and nobody knew where he was.
Well, and now what's happening too is you're getting this tug of war that you always get in these situations between the East and the West, and it's kind of positioning the Ukraine as either the last outpost of the West or the last outpost of the East, and they're kind of caught in the middle. And I think it was Kissinger. I was reading an article written by Kissinger that said, what they have to do is they got to position themselves as a bridge between the two on their own terms. They can exist that way if they're allowed to. On the one hand, you have Putin who's threatening, the military action, things like that, which I don't think anybody wants. I mean, you've got a Cold War status situation there where, nobody wants to be the author of their own suicide, neither the East or the West. There's nothing in it for you if you do that. On the other hand, you have What's next? Sanctions. You're going to have John Kerry over there shaking his fist and saying, I'm going to send a strongly worded message. And I mean strong words that we don't like this, you know, and they're going to go, they'll roll their eyes and go, okay, John, you know, if it's important enough, maybe you'll even put on a pair of socks. But the thing is, you know, you have this tug of war going on now. Nobody can even get up for sanctions. I mean, the Brits don't want to put these hard sanctions on. And so now you've got a situation where everybody's, you know, on the one side rattling sabers and on the other side, you know, kind of clicking their, you know, their fountain pen, their Bic pen, you know, so that I'm going to write a strongly worded letter. Nobody's doing anything. And this thing is just escalating. And what happened? I mean, we were talking before we went on the air with the situation with the Crimean Parliament.
Sure, yeah.
Was that really the Crimean Parliament that did that?
Well, it was a bunch of people sitting in Parliament, happened to be in Crimea, right next to the river.
Right next to the river, but they had basically just come out of the river from Russia, didn't they? I mean, that's not really.
Yeah, you had the Russian. I was about to say Soviet, but there were the Russians. The Russian military down there at the naval base, who put on unmarked uniforms, as they're called. Now, I know that in World War II, if you had an unmarked uniform, you were called a spy and you were shot. I'm not sure what you call an unmarked uniform nowadays, but anyway, they took up guns and they took up positions and basically carved out the territory of Crimea and just went ahead and took it and then installed a whole bunch of people into the Crimean Parliament, who promptly went ahead and voted to rejoin Russia. So,
well, it's, you know, the same thing happened during the Civil War here when Union soldiers went into Tennessee, sat in the state house and elected Tennessee back into the Union. And didn't have a lot of validity either. Now, this ultimatum they have from this, you know, the air quotes Crimean Parliament says that once the referendum is voted on in March later this month, that any Ukrainians holding weapons will be considered to be insurgents. And you've got that to deal with.
That's nice. It sounds familiar, though, doesn't it? I mean, I think I used to hear stuff like that around, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s or whatever. You had, somebody once said about education, you know, we wouldn't give our enemies guns. Why in the world would we give them an education? That sort of thing. That was another one of those famous Soviet philosophies. Yeah. Actually, I was just sitting here looking at, I got a picture of the former president of Ukraine, Yanukovych. I'm sitting here and I couldn't help but look at this thing and he's got this real dark head of hair, you know, and the first thing you think of, a politician with a real dark head of hair at his age is it's got to be a rug. And I thought, well, you know, what if you took that rug off his head? And then I realized actually who he was and why he went missing. He's actually the mayor of Toronto. He looks identical. Except the one guy's got no hair and the other guy's got black hair. So he didn't go missing. He was just on a bender. That's all.
He's on Jimmy Kimmel. So they do have similar styles of management, which seems to be anything goes, you know. So
exactly. Well, particularly them.
Seems to be happening here is that Putin has kind of, you know, just it's a kind of a puppet regime that he has in place right now, and he's going to try to make, you know, strides into that. And it's just like, what can be done, you know? And that's what's going to affect things economically. I mean, not so much for the United States, because their trade only represents, our trade with Russia is about 1%, but,
well, that's it. I figured we'll get into that a little bit more after the break. Yeah. We kind of run through it from an economic standpoint and really kind of, you know, we got to take a look and see at what exactly we're going to be facing here. Is this going to be an impact? If so, what kind of impact could we expect? And we might have to take a look a little bit at a worst case scenario, if you will.
Well, there's just a lot of upheaval there and people being injured and killed in some situations. And, you know, for us, it's one of those things that's, you know, it doesn't really touch you in that way, but it will have an effect on us. So we're going to get to break right now, and we're going to come back and kind of close our discussion on the Ukraine and how it's – we'll get into how it's going to affect markets here and what we're doing. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Money at Work.
Welcome back to Money at Work on Talk Zone. Here's Steve Memory and Brian Bourdon.
Thanks. Welcome back to the second segment of Money at Work here, March 6, 2014. Before we went to break, Steve and I were discussing events over in the Ukraine, which seems to be escalating at this point. Don't mean to say that in a too ominous a way, but it's just that in the diplomatic sense. I mean, things are – everybody's at loggerheads over what to do, but nobody really seems to want to do anything what do you want to say, decisive in something that, well, this is what we're going to do and we're going to end this right now. This seems like something that could play out for a while, and as such, the headlines of this could theoretically affect the market for days and weeks to come.
Well, you know, I would almost flip that around and say that if it plays out over time, we're less likely to find ourselves in the circumstance where we're going to see a significant impact on the market.
Okay, so what you're saying is, Brian, I totally disagree with what you just said.
Not exactly. You know, I mean, if somebody comes out and says, hey, we're going to end this right now, what is it going to do to end this right now? You know, to end this right now would require, well, first of all, somebody would have to develop a backbone and say,
we don't have the players in place on either side of the pond to do that.
You know, and this isn't becoming a blockade or a standoff a la the Cuban Missile Crisis by any means, you know. But we do have the PR in place, if you will, in the United States to create the feelings of an issue like that. If you recall, I think it was a couple of days ago, they said, oh, yes, the Russians fired an intercontinental ballistic missile. I'm watching the headlines scroll across CNN, and what? The last time we heard of anybody firing a missile, it was the North Korean president, you know, who got ticked off at a wave, as you say. You know, yeah. Somebody knocked him over. Let's fire a missile into the sea. But, you know, the fact is that the missile firing was just part of the overall test firing that the Russians go through normally, and it was on the docket and had been scheduled for some time. It didn't have a warhead attached. Nothing was going on to say, hey, we're rattling sabers. It's just that somebody in the newsroom picked it up and said, hey, this sounds ominous and this will grab attention. You know, and we're an ADD nation. We've got to go ahead and get everybody's attention. And so we've got to be able to get the latest, most ominous sounding news bite and throw that up in front of you to say, this is what's going on. So, you know, if we were to find ourselves in a circumstance where somebody said, okay, we're ending this now, you know, the problem is that kind of a definitive statement or that kind of a definitive position with the players we have in place right now would almost doom us to a circumstance of protracting this thing out well beyond what it would likely result in. You know, I don't know Putin as well as maybe some of the players here in the United States, but we have a general idea about the philosophy of the current administration, and we know what's not going to happen. And we know the one thing that's not going to happen is we're not going to go ahead and put our soldiers anywhere near anything. You know, I think they're actually taking chicken Kiev off the restaurant menu down at the PX, right? You know, just to go ahead and avoid having any contact with anything that might be resembling Ukraine. You know, I mean, so we're not in that kind of a circumstance at this point in time.
Well, you were talking about, you know, how they put the crawl on there about the intercontinental ballistic missile. The other thing that they like to do, is talk about, well, you know, there's Citigroup or Citicorp has offices in Russia that could be closed down, and GM has a plant that could be closed down, and all this, you know, ominous, all these things could happen when these companies close down larger plants and larger headquarters in America every year. without a whole lot of, you know, fanfare. But, you know, if you can get Wolf Blitzer on there talking about how this could, my God, it could possibly happen. It's like, well, yeah, it happens all the time. But hey, in the context of the story, you know, they can make it even more ominous.
Staples just announced they were shutting down a bunch of places and a bunch of their retail store outlets. And I don't think it had anything to do with the conflict in the Ukraine. I could be wrong. I don't know. Maybe that's where Putin goes to shop or something. I'm not sure. Look, there are issues that are out there with the Ukraine and particularly with Russia, and they could have some impact. So we got to go ahead and just kind of take a look at them. But as you mentioned beforehand, Ukraine itself it amounts to what? 1% of our trade? Is that includes Russia, I believe, isn't it?
Yeah, that's all of Russia. Now in the first 9 months of open trade with the EU, the EU imported like $200 billion in goods and services from Russia. So it's more significant. I don't know what off the top of my head what percentage that is, but it's significantly more than the U.S. is doing. So it would have, but that only makes more sense geographically. But it would have a little more impact on them. But I don't think it's going to sink.
So we go ahead, we take a look at Ukraine, for example. The concern is, oh, gee, Ukraine has debt out there. What happens if it defaults? Well, Ukraine's announced that it needs $35 billion to be able to go ahead and take care of its bills for the next 2 years. Okay. $35 billion couldn't take the Senate out to lunch at Starbucks, quite frankly. Okay. We run deficits in the trillions of dollars. And we look at building a road to someplace in the middle of Alaska, you know, where everybody can park their car, get out and hunt antelope or whatever, and that costs you $40 billion, right? We provide condos for polar bears with air conditioning, and that costs us $50 billion. But, so the Ukraine is pretty, they're pretty well within their area. Look, not to say that it's going to be a tough go for them if they need to. They've already said that they would like to ask the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, for assistance. IMF stands ready to help them. And so we're not in a situation where any kind of default is necessarily going to occur. We don't see a circumstance that's going to cause any cascading failure. So the question is, where could difficulties arise? Well, quite frankly, difficulties can arise from the creation of any kind of overall heavy-handed sanctions. We're looking at a circumstance where the administration, Obama's administration, has come out and said, well, we want to isolate Russia. I mean, really, do we really want to do that? I mean, look how long it took to get them out of isolation, right? I mean, so are we're going to put up the cray paper wall now? I mean, is that something that we're going to go ahead and do? Do we need that? The fact of the matter is it's not going to impact us so much because we're not, as you say, 1%. But take a look at what happens with the EU. The European Union relies on Russian crude and their oil and natural gas to the tune of about 35% of their imports. Okay. This is where the EU gets its energy. If we go ahead and we say, this is the reason you say Great Britain out there says, okay, we're not planning on doing anything anytime soon, because they know darn well this is where most of their oil comes from. You figure, okay, well, that just affects the EU, but it doesn't, because oil is traded on a global market. You remove that as a possibility, and all of a sudden we're going to see significant increases in prices. And we don't really want to have that. I mean, it's the kind of thing that could significantly undermine the global recovery, and I use my little air quotes to go ahead and drive that point home. That's not necessarily a good result. So I think at least for now we've got some folks who have backed off of this possibility of saying, hey, look, we want to go ahead and isolate you, or we're going to do all of the economic stuff that we can to make sure that we disrupt your country. Obama's come out now, and I guess they're freezing the assets of the Russians who are I don't know how they're figuring this out, but I guess they're freezing assets of people they figure are fomenting problems. I guess the insurrection against the most recent insurrectionists. I'm not sure about that.
But, well, one name that I can tell you is not on the blacklist is Putin.
Yeah, right, exactly.
They've left him off. So, you know, I mean, there's a tendency, I think, especially in this administration, to think that once you've said something, you've taken care of it. Now that the words are out there, that's it. It's over and done with.
I
was talking to Lily a little bit earlier, and she, reminded me that, to say that, like, three of the companies that we're big on that we were buying here, Disney, Qualcomm, Trinity, they're all approaching 52-week highs even now.
Sure.
So not everything's going to be, you know, don't get the idea that everything is going to be tied to this Ukraine thing. It's not.
No.
But there are certain things, you know, there are going to be headline days. Things are going to happen.
Sure.
And the market's going to move. The main thing that we're telling you here is we're kind of explaining the situation to you to put a face on it and put it in perspective that you're not thinking, oh, what's going on over there? How's this? The bottom line is it's really not going to have a huge effect on what's going to go on in your day-to-day life. It could represent some opportunities here and there, like you were talking about in energy.
Sure.
But overall, I don't think it's something that should be keeping you up at night if you're an investor.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, there's going to have there are people who have investments in some of the ETFs like the BRIC, you know, some of the emerging markets. Russia's considered part of that. And this kind of a thing could have a little bit of an impact. There could be an impact on Germany. They have about three times the amount of trade with Russia that we do. And anything that affects Germany is going to affect the rest of the EU. So there is the possibility for some impact. But look, Russia's had a serious situation in their economy as it stands. I mean, they're expecting, on a best-case scenario, zero growth, okay? So, you know, you're not expecting a better situation in Russia right now. Probably a decent opportunity to pull back on some of your investments in some of those emerging markets, if you haven't already, particularly the BRIC. You consider what happened in just the incursion in Georgia, which resulted in, what, a 30% deflation of the Russian ruble. So we're likely to see some of that kind of impact. But the carryover to the United States is something that we don't see, at least not right now, and certainly not something significant, unless we just see a serious mishandling of everything that's going on there. And, you know, there's too many people really in place, too many hands and too many minds and too many mouths to create that kind of a mishandling of the situation.
We're coming up on the bottom of the hour now. When we come back, we're going to get into another kind of an economic, political kind of debate here on another subject. This one is, you may have heard of this. This is called the income gap that was discussed in the last State of the Union presentation. We're going to delve into that a little deeper when we come back. You're listening to Money at Work from OV Capital on TalkZone.com.
And now, more of Money at Work on TalkZone.com. Here's Steve Memory and Brian Bourdon.
Thank you. Welcome back to Money at Work here from OV Capital Management on TalkZone.com. I'm Brian Bourdon. I'm joined by Steve Memory. We kind of put the finishing touches on the deal in the Ukraine to bed at the bottom of the hour. And as we get into this next half hour, what I wanted to do, Steve, is I wanted to talk about something that we had been discussing recently, something that kind of came to the fore in the State of the Union address, the income gap. That is the gap between, you know, it's kind of the class warfare, the haves and the have-nots, and this gap that's in between somehow being unfair to those that, you know, don't have millions and millions of dollars, and what the correlation is between, you know, if so few people have all the money, how could anything that we're doing even be possible? So,
sure.
So I wanted you to kind of take a run at that and explain it deeper, because right now it's just one of those things where if you're on that side of the ledge, oh yeah, there's a great income gap. So much of this is emotional conjecture rather than critical thought as to, you know, what exactly is this? And so I thought maybe you'd break that down for us.
Sure. This concept, this income inequality or income gap area, has become a bit of a rallying cry for some folks in the progressive side of things. And I think
progressive,
it's
progressive. That's what we used to call them, liberals, right? The progressive.
We used to call them liberals, but we almost actually would welcome a good old fashioned liberal from the 1980s at this point in time, because we the liberals of the 80s at least understood one thing, and that was this was a capitalistic economy. It was built on capitalism. It thrives on capitalism. And we need to make sure that the backbone of our economy and our way of life, remains intact. Progressives, on the other hand, kind of came to the fore a bit more with the economic collapse of 2007-2008. And the rallying cry then was capitalism has failed. And these were all the folks out there who were, you know, for the past 20 years had been bristling every time somebody said, look, communism failed and you can see it. Okay. And so they were more than happy and almost exultant in this declaration that capitalism has failed. And the fact of the matter is that it wasn't capitalism that had failed in as much as it was an interventionist policy in capitalism that causes the failure. But the, a lot of what's come to the fore since then, the idea of income inequality, that we need to go ahead and we need to boost the middle class, income gap, let's close that income gap. These are the things that much of the progressive party is really talking about. Obama back, I guess, in December 4th, was talking about income inequality and the income gap, saying that it creates problems with people trying to make ends meet, the ability to pay for college, buy a home, save for retirement, when in fact, really, these things have absolutely nothing to do with an income gap. Okay. The main point of an income gap is that so much money is controlled by so few people. And when you're talking about buying a home, if you can't sell enough houses to one person to go ahead and make all of home prices move. As any of us who own homes know, that you take a look and there are different areas of homes. There's the entry level market. There's a mid level market. Those are upper level markets and they move independently. If you have a condo, someplace, just because the overall market goes up in houses does not mean the price of your condo is going up. You know, and that's one of those things. Because why is that? Because the upper income folks don't necessarily buy those condos unless they happen to be down in Boca. You know, so this rationale about, well, because of this income gap, therefore it's affecting these other areas of life, really doesn't don't mix. It's part of an as Ludwig von Mises, he's an a Austrian economist. He came out. One of the things he kind of said about the conflict between classical liberalism, which means essentially individual freedoms and capitalism, and the socialists or the progressives, is that they against, as his quote is, against logic, they set moralism. Which means that they're not arguing apples and apples. They're not arguing the logic of economic data. They argue the feeling. Okay? So against theory, they have emotional prejudice. All right? So you can go ahead and you can show, economically speaking, how certain things will work. But it's much easier to go ahead and get people upset about how much they have and how much they don't have.
And that's kind of the point I wanted to get to, because it seems to me those that are proffering income inequality, the income gap, they seem more intent in reducing it from the top down than from, you know, the bottom up. And by that, I mean, they want it, they're more interested in so let's give the people that have the money their comeuppance. Let's take from them and level it off that way. Let's not, don't bring the bottom up. Bring the top down, because then that's that Schadenfreude. You know, I'll feel so much better if you're not doing well. There seems to be too much of that in that's underlying this whole idea.
Right. Well, part of
where,
it comes,
where does that get us as an economy? You know, because those people that do it, that are up at the, they're the job creators for the most part, and the people trying to reach that level, they'll have jobs. So if you tear them down, you're going to cost jobs. You're going to have an even bigger gap. The gap is just going to be at a lower level.
Right. Well, this is part of the problem inherent in their philosophy, and it's why they want to sidestep the economics of the issue. Okay, because if you go ahead and you create an environment whereby middle class jobs are created, GDP growth is increased, you are going to have people who are outliers, who are inordinately successful. You can create 100,000 new jobs in the middle class, but if one person goes ahead and creates a situation whereby they're making too much money, the progressives see this as failure, and they see that as a problem. So it almost doesn't have anything to do with the middle class, in as much as it has us needing to go ahead and essentially lop off that top end of the economy and take it and redistribute it. It does two things. It goes ahead and it keeps the people in government in power, because why? They're going ahead and handing out money. And it feeds into everybody's emotional attitude that says, oh, wait a minute, they're making too much. You take a look at the policies of the current administration. What are the things that are at the heart of what they're doing? Well, you have higher taxes on the wealthy. That's a confiscatory policy, not intended to go ahead and increase the benefit of the people in the middle class, simply to penalize the people at the upper end. You take a look at Obamacare. Obamacare is designed to go ahead and what? Provide more people insurance? We have roughly the same number of people insured, maybe, if you go ahead and don't count some of the upcoming, the anticipated cancellations and the fact that we have to reset the premiums on everything. The idea is that we're trying to get certain people on the Cadillac end of things to pay more. Okay? Or, as we're looking at, essentially what results from the increased tax on Cadillac plans is that the Cadillac plans aren't offered. So despite how much money you have, you can't have better health care insurance. Not that we don't have it out there, okay? Not that we're getting better coverage for everybody else, but no, certain people at the upper end, even if they can afford it, cannot buy better health care. Okay. This is, again, it's the reductionist from the top. The third thing that we are going ahead and taking a look at as part of a tenet of this administration is higher minimum wage. Well, what does the higher minimum wage do? Does it actually go ahead and lift people out of poverty? And the answer is no, it doesn't. Economically speaking, we can show where a higher minimum wage creates competition at the low end of the economic scale, such that it throws more people out of work and results not in higher overall standards of living, but it just shifts the standard of living higher. It makes it more difficult for those people who have been put out of work to find their way back into the workforce.
Well, and there's a significant difference between what we call the living wage and the minimum wage.
Sure. Yes.
They're not interchangeable, because you'll hear, well, the minimum, it's not a living wage. It was never designed to be. What it's designed to do is that so small businesses can stay in business, so they can hire people, get work done, provide them with some income, and still keep their doors open. So this idea that, well, we got to get them, yeah, they've got to make more money, they got to get benefits. Well, then the business ceases to exist. So now you don't even have that minimum wage job any longer. It was never intended to be something that, yeah, you were going to get minimum wage, you were going to work 40 years, and then you were going to retire with a gold watch. That's not what it is. It's basically part-time work. That's what it was designed to do.
Well, look, we can get into a lot of different things and a lot of results of these, but you have to keep up. What is it all geared towards? You know, what is the idea of going ahead doing, providing everybody with a college education and all this kind of stuff? What is the ultimate goal here of a progressive attack on this income disparity? And part of what it is put forward by Sarah Robinson. Okay, she's one of these futurists, kind of tries to imagine things. And as she says, the capitalism's biggest flaw is its inherent reliance on growth. That instead of growing economies, we should go ahead and find that level at which everything just remains the same. Okay? And we're already starting to get that. So you can see, everybody wonders, hey, wait a minute, why is the economy so slow to recover? Why is it slow to go ahead and move? And it's because it's not accidental, it's intentional. The policies that are there, that are put in place to take down that top end, inherently are made to reduce growth. This is Steve Memory. We're OV Capital. We're at coming up on our break here, so we're going to go right out. OV Capital coming to you from Old Town, Alexandria. This is Money at Work. We'll see you in a few.
You're listening to Money at Work on TalkZone.com. Back to Steve Memory and Brian Bourdon.
I got to tell you, the headsets are useless if you don't put them on. So they're waiting to come back on. I realized I wasn't wearing them, so I quick put them back on. I want to recap what we've done today. We went into the Ukraine. We went into that situation. We talked about something that has profound effect probably on the midterm elections, and that's something you're going to start hearing about. So we wanted to preface it for you, and that's the income gap. But we wanted to get to now, and again, I want to remind you this has been kind of a political kind of a show, and you've probably gathered that your hosts are somewhat on the conservative side of the fiscal ledger here, and this is not typically what our show is like. A lot of it is more geared towards investments, the markets, things like that. But we wanted to take a look at some of the things going on politically that are affecting what goes on in our economy, what goes on in the market. And what I wanted to do in this last segment, Steve, is get you on the track of talking about some of the economic news, the economic data that we're dealing with now. So I wanted you to kind of take and run with that. This is the shorter segment of our show, so I just wanted you to kind of take that and run with it towards the top of the hour.
Yeah, sure, no problem. And I just like to go ahead and say, the market is, for the most part, apolitical. It's happy when it knows what's going on and unhappy when it has confusion or it doesn't have an idea of where things are headed. That being said, economic policy has an impact on your 401k. It has an impact on your savings account. It has an impact on your brokerage account. And we're not political or ideological from the standpoint of trying to go ahead and change the world on a social basis. But what we do have is a particular view as to what actually benefits the economy. What puts money in your pocket through capitalistic means? What goes ahead and benefits your 401k? What makes you have a better living? What makes you have a better retirement? And it's because of that that we can go ahead and we address these issues. And we've talked about some of the policies and maybe how they were having an impact. And when we take a look at these economic numbers that are coming out, we see economic numbers as a function of the policies that are out there. Current numbers that came out from the Labor Department, non-farm business sector, labor productivity, we take a look at it, increased at a 1.8 annual percentage rate during the fourth quarter of 2013. You think, okay, that sounds decent, but when we look at it, we see annual average output per hour. Okay, this is a nice way of slicing things down, saying, all right, what do we see as the average output of a person's endeavors? What are they doing? Are we becoming more productive? Are we becoming less productive? Productivity rose by 0.5% between 2012 and 2013. But since 2010, productivity has increased at an average annual rate of 0.8%. Well, what do these things mean? Well, what it means is it appears that our productivity is slowing down somewhat. Okay. If our productivity starts slowing down, that means our gross domestic product slows down if we're not adding new jobs. So we go ahead and take a look at what happens on the jobs front. Are we hiring more people to make up for that slack? Are we hiring fewer people? What's going on? You know, we obviously are in a situation where unemployment has been high for a long time. You know, we used to go ahead and target about 4% as full employment. And, you know, there's a lot of things that go into that. But ADP's February estimates came out. So they have what they call a national employment report. That came out yesterday. ADP, as you may know, does a lot of the payroll for a number of the big companies out there. And because of this, they can make some estimates on what the overall employment figures look like throughout the United States. So the estimate that came out yesterday, they estimate 139,000 American workers were hired to private sector payrolls. Okay.
A lot.
Well, this is in February. I mean, it's nice that we're hiring people as opposed to not hiring people. But the economic forecast for February was 155,000. That's a big difference. You're talking, you know,
10%.
Well, yeah, almost 16,000 people.
Yeah.
Right. So, in addition to this, they went ahead and they revised January numbers. January numbers, they revised down by 48,000. Okay. So we're coming out with employment numbers for February that are significantly lower than what we expected. And we're revising January numbers down, and the January numbers had already been below expectations, and now we're revising them down even farther. Okay. There's a lot of question about, oh, well, gee, you know, we've got bad weather and all, you know, and maybe that's causing some problems, et cetera, et cetera. But these 2 months have been the weakest, since January and February of 2011. Looks like we're moving in a wrong direction here, okay, from these numbers. We'd rather go ahead and see unemployment increasing or employment increasing. If we're on a road to recovery, you know, we expect that recovery to gain traction. You recall, they went ahead and said, oh, yeah, we've come out of this recession at a particular point in time. And now while we're on the recovery, well, you know, where is this? Are we seeing a significant growth? The one place we've seen significant movements has been in the market, the stock market. We've seen price improvement. 2013, great numbers. So far this year, we're actually up. We had the pullback in January. February came out, counteracted that nicely, and now we're up a couple of percent, about 2.5% or so, I believe, on the S&P 500. Okay. But the question is, where are we going to go ahead and see that sustain itself? At some point in time, we need good, positive economic numbers to come out and continue and to take us farther down that road.
Well, you know, one of the things that you alluded to almost immediately was the drop in productivity and, you know, being down. And I think, you know, if you're listening and think of yourself, you know, in microcosm, you can't spend your way out of financial difficulties. You have to produce your way out of it.
Certainly.
And with productivity being down, that's kind of a harbinger and you know, the market being up in the face of a drop in productivity can be somewhat of a facade, you know, and I know right. We were talking about that in terms of, you know, should we be out there raising a little cash?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I'll get to that in a second because there's something else that kind of comes through this. But you touched on a point that I made to somebody just a couple of weeks ago, and that is, you know, when you talk about the government creating jobs, okay, the government doesn't create – the government creates positions. It fills positions. It can put somebody in a position and pay them money, but a job is something that is created in the business sector to meet a need. It provides a person servicing a position to meet a consumer need.
And it creates wealth. It doesn't simply recycle wealth that's already there.
The government creates positions, but it does not meet needs that are out there in the consumer area. one of the last issues I wanted to get to was this manufacturing orders. We started talking this, towards the end of this summer. We started to see some lag in manufacturing orders. And we're taking a look, January 2014, new orders for manufactured goods decreased by 0.7%. Okay, shipments decreased by 0.3%. Unfilled orders were unchanged. Inventories rose 0.2%. All right, when we take a look at all this, it means that there's a bit of a backlog and people are not going ahead and making the purchases that we would expect if the economy was fully into this recovery. Okay, so factory goods fell more than expected. All of these kinds of things, when they show new orders received by factories slipped by 0.4%. And so shipments of new orders fell for the second month in a row here in January. These are the kind of things that when we take a look at a recovering economy, an economy that's moving forward, we see traction being gained. And we're not really seeing that right now. What we're seeing is things moving in a different direction. And actually what we see, the Philly Federal Reserve Chairman came out. I've lost his name here real quick. I forgot it. I wanted to call him Fred, but he's actually Charles. He was saying, look, we're seeing gross domestic product at about 2.4%, and Plosser, that was his name, Charles Plosser. He says that the country was pretty close, his quotation words, to a steady state of growth, and that we may not get back to where we once thought it could be. Like I said beforehand, when you take a look at policies, ultimately policies have an impact on the way the economy is going. And we are now being told that happy days were yesterday, that we need to go ahead and adjust to this quote unquote new reality.
Well, keeping with the new reality, we're going to have to end it on that note, but I'd like to pick it up again sometime because I think the show has been really interesting for me, and it's been kind of a change of pace. I hope that you all have liked it too. We'll be back with you next Thursday, the 13th at 2 p.m. on TalkZone.com. You've been listening to Money at Work from OV Capital Management.